Welcome to the Bob Siegel Show podcast on the Cross Global Media Radio Network. Visit cgmradio.com/Bob to subscribe on your favorite podcasting platform.
Welcome to the Bob Siegel Show. Today we continue our discussion of the Hebrew Roots Movement. Once again, I am a Hebrew Christian. I do not accept the Hebrew Roots Movement, but here's a question I get asked frequently. Bob, are you saying there's no place at all for holding on to or celebrating Jewish customs in the church? Well, my friend, that all depends on whether this is viewed as a voluntary or mandatory observance. If it's voluntary, no problem. Certainly there is a place for having church services with ethnic flavor, be they Jewish or any other nationality. Paul himself acknowledged as much for the sake of testimony. Paul spoke at the level and in the language of the people he wanted to reach. As far as evangelism went, he approached Jews and Greeks quite differently. 1 Corinthians chapter 9 says, "To the Jews I became like a Jew to win the Jews. To those under the law, I became like one under the law, though I myself am not under the law, so as to win those under the law." In this vein, one might indeed reach his or her Jewish friends more easily with the gospel by bringing them to some Saturday Messianic service rather than a Sunday morning church service. That can be a great place to start. But there is also the question of where we will end. Paul seemed to hold both a beginning and ending principle in place. As far as outreach went, to the Jews he became as a Jew. As far as discipleship went, he wanted Jews to know that their Jewishness was no longer important. Instead, Christ and the fellowship he grants with all peoples is more important, like we already looked at in Galatians. In church, there is neither Jew nor Greek. Paul was running into something much different with the churches of Galatia, where such customs were not considered optional. For this reason, Paul wanted them to understand that they did not have the luxury of clinging to a few rituals such as circumcision unless they were going to go back and obey the entire law of Moses. Galatians 5:3, "Again, I declare to every man who lets himself be circumcised that he is obligated to obey the whole law." My friends, nobody does that. Instead, they cherry-pick the customs that are convenient to them. They may enjoy keeping kosher or celebrating the Sabbath, but who, for example, makes animal sacrifices today? No Christian whom I ever met, although I'm sure there's always some nutcase somewhere who could do anything. Whenever I meet Orthodox Jews, Jewish Christians, or just plain legalistic Christians who claim we must follow the law, and there are many of them, Jew and Gentile alike, who say they must follow the law, I ask a very simple question. Do you conduct animal sacrifices? That's a fairly large chunk of the Mosaic law. Almost every single time I hear the exact same reply. We can't. The temple has been destroyed. All right, look, this argument may sound convenient, but it immediately suffocates people in the quicksand it is made from. There was no temple from Moses to Solomon, a period of several hundred years, yet God still commanded the sacrificial regulations. Well, politics of present-day Israel and the existence of the Muslim dome on the rock on the Temple Mount make it presently impossible to rebuild a temple, a tabernacle, portable in the days of Moses. A tabernacle could be recreated at any time. Protests from PETA notwithstanding, there is no reason why anyone claiming that the Old Covenant is still in operation should not be making animal sacrifices. But don't hold your breath. It's not happening, and I don't expect it to happen. We must conclude that even amongst the most zealous adherents to Jewish customs, the entire law is not, in fact, being observed. In lieu of Paul's challenge to consistency, they are hard-pressed to explain themselves. Well, there are still other arguments that people use. Here's one I get all the time. "I have heard that the law and the gospel are one and the same, and that the gospel is just a broader expression of the law." That is simply not true. Those who make such a claim justify their position only by doing verbal gymnastics with the very plain teaching of Scripture. Never have Paul's words to the Galatians been more relevant. One would think he was traveling through time, writing directly to today's Hebrew roots movement. Observe the beginning of chapter 3 in Galatians. You foolish Galatians, who has bewitched you? Before your very eyes, Jesus Christ was clearly portrayed as crucified. I would like to learn just one thing from you. Did you receive the Spirit by observing the law or by believing what you heard? Are you so foolish? After beginning with the Spirit, are you now trying to attain your goal by human effort? Have you suffered so much for nothing? If it really was for nothing, does God give you His Spirit and work miracles among you because you observe the law or because you believe what you heard? Later, in the latter part of the chapter, he continues, "Before the coming of this faith, we were held in custody under the law, locked up until the faith that was to come would be revealed. So the law was our guardian until Christ came, that we might be justified by faith. Now that this faith has come, we are no longer under a guardian." Okay. Now, everybody who listened to those passages of Scripture were listening to the same verses. Anybody who reads from Galatians is reading from the same book in the Bible. My friends, the contrast between saving faith and law could not possibly be made plainer. The law has been fulfilled. The new covenant is here. As Jesus put it so well, let us not mix new wine with old wineskins. Now, what exactly did Jesus mean the law has been fulfilled? To start, instead of outward commands, God offers us a relationship with His Spirit who changes our heart and makes us hopefully so loving that we no longer need commands such as don't kill or don't steal or don't mess around with your neighbor's wife. If we are already loving, if we are already unselfish, and we can't be that way, at least not completely without the Spirit of God. If we are already unselfish, if we are already treating people in the way we want to be treated, those incentives will come naturally. Matthew chapter 7, part of the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says, "In everything, do to others what you would have them do to you, for this sums up the law and the prophets." Paul taught something very similar in Galatians. This is no surprise because they were a people who had forgotten how the law had been fulfilled by the gospel. Galatians 5:14, "The entire law is summed up in a single command, love your neighbor as yourself." Galatians 5:6, "The only thing that counts is faith expressing itself through love." We call this a fulfillment of the moral code, and it goes well with Jeremiah 31, through whom God predicted, "I will put my law within them. I will write it upon their hearts." The other part of the law, ritual law, was fulfilled obviously through Jesus' death on the cross. The animal sacrifices of old were a foreshadowing of what Jesus would later do for all people. The blood of lambs and goats provided a picture of atonement so that people needing to be saved by Jesus could be saved before he even came. We'll see Moses in heaven. We'll see King David in heaven. We'll see Abraham in heaven. They didn't understand that a man named Jesus was going to someday come and die for their sins, but they did understand they were sinful. They understood that there needed to be a blood atonement, and these animal sacrifices were not truly atoning for them. It was giving them a way to look toward the cross. We as New Testament believers look back at the cross. Look at these words in Hebrews chapter 10. "Day after day, every priest stands and performs his religious duties. Again and again, he offers the same sacrifices, which can never take away sins. But when this priest had offered for all time," this priest meaning now Jesus, he calls Jesus the high priest, he calls Jesus the sacrifice that the priest is making. "But when this priest had offered for all time one sacrifice for sins, he sat down at the right hand of God, and since that time he waits for his enemies to be made his footstool, for by one sacrifice he has made perfect forever those who are being made holy." As you can see, the New Testament is so clear that we are not under the law. Well, there is one more card that people play. And I alluded to this earlier when I mentioned that one of the teachings of the Hebrew Roots Movement is that the New Testament had originally been written in Hebrew. When it got translated into Greek, a lot of Greek ideas came in. When I go to the New Testament teachings from Jesus and the apostles, and mostly from Paul, there have been other places, but a lot of them from Paul, it's very easy to say, oh, well, Paul wasn't a true apostle. Paul's writings don't count. We will discuss this provocative and erroneous belief on the next episode of The Bob Siegel Show.
The Bob Siegel Show podcast is a production of Bob Siegel and Cross Global Media. Visit us online and subscribe to the show at cgmradio.com/Bob.